Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. We've got a returning guest today, haven't we, Chris?
Yeah, we have. We've got Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is a historian, television presenter and author of popular history books and novels, including Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, and Jerusalem, the biography. And he's been on before to talk about the Romanovs, 1613 to 1918, but he's here today to talk about his new book, The World. Simon, welcome to History Hack, and how are you doing?
Great to be here, as always. It's great to be back. Really nice to talk to you guys.
This is number three, I think, because we did your letters book as well, didn't we?
We did, but we can never do too much.
We can't. And, I mean, this just I think, destroys every book you've ever written in terms of scope and stuff. It's fair to say it's ambitious. It's not just a history of humanity, is it? But it's how humanity is all linked together as one family. What on earth made you want to take on like such a dramatic and challenging approach to a book?
Well, I've always wanted to do it since I was much younger, and I just wanted to find a way to make it work. And because I, in my Jerusalem book, I used families to tell the history of Jerusalem, which is a sort of history of the world in a way, in a very focused way. I suddenly thought I could do the same for the world altogether, and I wondered if it would work. So I made this huge kind of map of all families that I wanted to cover, and how they were all linked together, and how they crisscrossed each other. And I realized that I could do it in a single narrative, including the Americas and Australia, which are left out of much of Euro-African Asian history, which is all linked together. And strangely, it has worked. I mean, obviously, it was a sort of terrifying experience writing it and seeing how it would hang together, but somehow it has. And I think it's because families, we're fascinated with families, and the idea is really through families to catch the scope and span of world history, but recapture the intimacy, the grit, the juice of biography.
How do you even start picking what goes in and what gets left out?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's very hard to decide what went in and what went out. But obviously, I mean, really important things have to go in. And there's all sorts of technological things about, you know, the development of medicine and fertilizer and the discovery of bacteria and all sorts of things like that that are hugely important and have to go in. And the Industrial Revolution, migrations, pandemics, and so that the choice of the families are often decided by how if they are useful to tether those things to. Because what effectively I've done in this book is to use very personal stories about families to tether really more serious, deeper, wider themes. And so that's often what makes me decide which to put in and which to leave out. Of course, not everything can go in. But one of the decisions that I made was to treat African, Asian, South American families, some of them royal, some of them ruling families, exactly as I would treat the Habsburgs or the Romanovs or European or North American families. And I think that gives it a diversity that's quite unusual.
I think it really does. And one of the things, you have to explain to people how you start the book, because I love what you chose to do with it. So how far back do you go and tell everybody about the family that you used first?
Well, it starts off with two families. One is just the footsteps at Habsburg Beach in Norfolk. The first footsteps of a family 950,000 years ago on the beach. which symbolizes the mission of the book, really, because women are so often left out of history, and so are children. So that's one of the missions of the book. But the book really opens 4,000 years ago, in about 2,300 BC, in Akkad, in what's now Iraq, with the family of Sargon and his daughter, Enheduanna, who was really fascinating character. That, you know, she was a prominent woman. She was a princess. She was the daughter of an emperor. She was the high priestess of a goddess and ran a huge temple and many estates. She was also an authoress, a poetess, and she was also probably the first victim of sexual abuse that we know of in history. So on so many levels, she is a kind of brilliant person to start with. In some ways, a kind of modern figure from 4,000 years ago, and a great way to introduce the concept of the book.
You cover quite a few famous people in the book from many different fields. Are you afraid you've left anyone out, or have you sort of, since it's been published, woken up in the middle of the night and go, oh, damn it, I forgot so-and-so?
I had many nights like that. That's a really good question. I had many nights like that in the writing of the book, because I wanted to make the narrative really fresh and not always follow the traditional conventional path. It meant that sometimes I left people out. And I do remember waking up one night about 4 a.m. and suddenly thinking, oh my God, I've left Jesus Christ out of the book. there are people that I'd like to put more in about. There are lots of people. I mean, Marshall Pilsudski, for example, who I know you're interested in, Alex, is, you know,
he's in, the leaders, he's in the isn't it?
He's in the book. But I'd like to put more, and I might in the next edition manage to sort of put a bit more about him, because he's such an interesting character. So there are people that I'd love to put more in about. But actually, I think the balance is just about right.
I think I really like the stories of people that I hadn't heard of. And you've already mentioned women. So if it's okay, we're just going to delve into a couple more of the women as well, of the people that like wouldn't be, if you were going to list your top 50 people in the history of humanity that you had to mention, these two ladies wouldn't be in it. So we should hear more about them. So can you tell us about Zenobia?
Oh, well, Zenobia is a really fascinating character. She comes from Palmyra. She's in fact, most probably Arab by descent. I mean, totally Arab by descent, perhaps with some Greek mixed in. But she becomes enormously important as the Roman Empire and in a massive crisis. And so her husband is killed or dies somehow. And she expands her empire and takes control of the kingdom. And in a very, very short period, I mean, the whole story lasts about not more than 10 years. She creates her own empire that extends from Egypt to Turkey, to Iraq today. And so she's really a fascinating person. And, you know, one of the cases in the book of, you know, women who literally kind of rule swathes of the world, and that most people haven't heard of.
Yeah, it's one of the great tragedies of written history that women like this do fall through the cracks and that people don't hear about them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a lot of others in there. I mean, for example, you know, in the Mongol Empire, which, you know, one of the mega families in the book, there are various mega families. I think the two big ones are the family of Muhammad the Prophet, who then went on to rule much of swathes of Eurasia, and then the Genghis Khan Tamerlane, which I treat as sort of one family, which almost 1,000 years rules huge parts of Asia, including India, of course, the Mughal dynasty. But in the Mongol Empire, you know, women were hugely important, and Sol Kukhtani was probably the most powerful of them, who dominated the Mongol Empire at its greatest extent for some decades. So you know, there's a character that we should all know about. And then, of course, there are a lot of Ottoman women who, like Hossam, for example, in the 17th century. You know, when in Britain we're all reading about James the First and Charles the First and Cromwell, she, for all those reigns, she was one of the dominant characters, or the dominant character, in the vast Ottoman Empire, and yet we've never heard of her. So one of the things that's been fun to do is to correct that in the book.
Another of these women is Lady Murasaki. Who is she?
Well, Lady Murasaki is another descriptive person. She's you know, in Middle Age, in medieval Japan, she was the first published novelist, and her novel and her diaries, which, by the way, are published in Penguin, so anyone can read them in a beautiful translation, you know, just show the delicacy, the brutality of the Japanese court. She was a companion to the empress, to several empresses. She was possibly a lover to the shogun, or certainly he flirted with her. But her great achievement is literary, and she's someone we should all know about. We should all celebrate. And I've used a lot of the diary and I've quoted from the novel, but especially the diary in the book. So I like always, whenever possible, to use the actual words of the people in the book. And so, even though this is a work of synthesis, of course, there's lots of primary sources in here, and you can hear the voice of Lady Murasaki. By the way, that was her nickname. It means Lady Wisteria, but it said a lot about Japan at that time that we actually don't know her real name, and yet she's this titanic historic and literary figure.
That's amazing. You already mentioned overarching themes of this book. You can't write a book like this without talking about really human traits, like good and bad, I guess, like war. One that really stuck out for me when I was looking through the book was migration, because I think it's so fundamental to your concept to trace humanity. How did you manage to, how would you even start mapping it to be able to get that thread going throughout the book?
Well, you're so right, Alex. You've really put your finger on it. Migration is probably the most important part of the book. In terms of themes, if you combine that with religion and also, you know, technology, the developments of technology that it plots. But migration is so important. I mean, there are just no pure races. There are no, the sort of idea of races and nations is somewhat contrived, and really, all nations are at some point created by the mixing of peoples, and that most of that happened through either invasions or migrations.
Mm.
I mean, invasions are usually armed men landing somewhere or galloping into new territory. Migrations include families and include men, women, and children.
So, you're right in thinking that the first big one would be people coming out of the African Rift Valley, wouldn't it?
Yeah, those were massive migrations that really formed Homo sapiens. But more than that's the very beginning of the book. But more than that, you know, there've been massive migrations in Africa in the 19th century. I mean, the Mfokane, which means the sort of the crushing, the explosion, it's translated in various ways, but that was an armed migration of peoples. The Zulus are normally blamed for it, but actually I look at Southern Africa in a much bigger way. That's one of the great things about world history.
Mm.
And you can see how Central and Southern Africa were formed by this massive movement of peoples. Some of them fighting the Zulus, some of them the Zulus conquering other peoples, some of them avoiding the Zulus, and also including many, many other tribes and nations that were formed at that time. And so that's Africa is part of it. But then there's migrations that formed the Anglo-Saxon peoples, for example, in early Britain. There are there are then the, you know, the arrival of the Normans. So Britain itself is completely formed by migrations. And of course, there's the fall of it at the same time as that was the fall of the Roman Empire, which I look at differently as well, because, you know, the migrations really had started much earlier than the official fall of the Roman Empire, which is given as a single date. In fact, the Roman Empire had ceased to be just the Roman Empire much, much earlier.
Yeah.
So when you look at migrations, it's such an interesting way. When you look at migrations and cover them, as this book does, you realize that history is much more gradual and much more complex and much more nuanced than we were led to believe when we sort of did it at school.
Mm.
If I can just say, you know, one of the things the book ends with the invasion of Ukraine by Putin this year. So it goes right up to modern times. And it ends with a conclusion that really looks into the future of the next 50 or 100 years. And that's the great thing about world history. It's a sort of tonic for turbulent times. But the one thing that is certain is that migration is going to be a massive, massive phenomenon, world-changing phenomenon in the next 50 years.
Yeah.
And that's one of the predictions in the book, is the pressure that will place on countries like our own.
Bearing in mind what we've just gone through with COVID in the last couple of years, history, well, especially world history, is full of pandemics and plagues. How's that affected global history? And just in your book.
Well, Chris, that's a great question. I mean, the book is filled with terrible diseases. It's also pervaded by a constant fear of imminent destruction and catastrophe, which is part of human nature, and has always been part of human nature.
Everyone thinks their generation is the one that's going to end the world, don't they? Like, this is worse than it's ever been.
The apocalypse. So it's such a deep, that's such a fascinating thing. It's such a deeply ingrained part of human nature. I have to say that it's, you know, we are living in a more perilous time in terms of what humans are doing to the world than we ever have been before.
Mm.
So we may have more reason to fear the end of the world now than ever before, but it's always been an essential part of human nature. And part of it is, of course, you know, fear of disease. And so the book is filled, as you said, with pandemics and epidemics. You know, the greatest one being the Black Death, the bubonic plague, which really changed the world. I mean, they are one of those super propellants. Wars can also do that, you know, achieve that, of course. But, you know, the Black Death really formed the modern world. And in some ways, killing massive numbers of people, reordering society, made possible the success of Europe. In world history, which is obviously a massive thing, and so yes, I mean there are we now give accounts of these events, and of course I wrote the book during COVID, as you said.
I've got to ask as well. You've taken on this challenge, and the climate at the moment. If you'd have gone too Eurocentric or American centric or white centric, you'd have got battered writing this book. So you have had to put your money where your mouth is with a global history of humanity and that. How far ranging were your sources?
It's funny you should say that about, you know, yes, there's a new history now which demands that, you know, it isn't just about you know, white men and Europeans, and isn't just about men at all, and is much more aware of diversity. But funny enough, you know, this suits my interests in history, and this suits exactly the history that I've always wanted to write. I mean, you know, I remember reading about places like Haiti and Ethiopia and Congo, you know, long ago. I've always wanted to write a history including those places that I read about as a young person. And so the diversity and the new sort of gender history is something that was always going to be part of this book. And was far from being sort of dragged screaming into writing this newly diverse global history. It suited me, and I've taken a delight in writing about these parts of the world and people and places that haven't been covered enough. And not only is it I think, the most diverse history. You know, I always made sure that in every case, you don't just discover about the Incas or the Mexica when a European kind of rocks up in their boat.
Yeah.
You know, in the book, you'll see that you always know these people decades and centuries before. And that's deliberate, of course, and makes it much more interesting. And of course, so that always suited me. And of course, the female history has always been missing. And I've always been fascinated with those characters. So as we talked about, yes, it's got people like Zenobia and Catherine the Great and Lady Murasaki, but there are others who are really obscure, like, you know, most readers probably won't know, like Marozia or Kosem, or Hürrem Sultan, who, you know, everyone should know about and celebrate. And so it's been a great delight. And there's another thing that's also important, which is it's not just the victor's history, just about big empires that succeed. I mean, yes, it has the British and French empires and Russia and America. But this is also a history of smaller places that most people won't have studied, like Albania, Haiti, yeah. Hawaii, Cambodia, Congo, and Angola. So these places are all featured in here massively. And that's been really fun to write. So, and obviously, you know, wherever possible, I sought primary sources that are published. But I wrote this from my study, and, you know, I've read massively to do it. And hopefully in most cases, these are based on the later scholarship, which is important, and wherever possible, primary sources where they're available. And I've been lucky that I have traveled really widely, and I've been to most of these places.
Yeah.
And so it's also based on being there and meeting, and in the 20th century, 21st century, meeting some of the protagonists myself. And, you know, I put them in the book with their conversations with me.
I thought my COVID baby, which was a 400-page illustrated kids book on World War One, was like, I was quite impressed with myself. But this, as far as COVID babies go, this is epic.
Thank you.
When you were writing this, who did you absolutely not expect to be including, and who has somehow ended up in the book?
Oh, I mean, a lot of. I'm just really trying to think of a name or example, but there are lots of those.
David Bowie's in there, isn't he? Was that intentional from the very beginning, or were you like, no, screw it, at some point, I'm going to put him in as well. He belongs in here.
Yeah, I mean, I think music, that's a very good question. That's the answer to Chris's point. I mean, you know, there were people that suddenly proved perfect. For example, you know, when you're doing families, you want to do modern and contemporary art. Mm. Of course, I had Freud in the book. Suddenly I realized, of course, the Freuds, you know, Lucian Freud is the ideal artist to put in, who emerged in the 60s. And actually, so Lucian Freud is, you know, featured in the book. And yeah, the great rock stars, Elton John, the Stones, the Beatles, are very important. And I'll tell you who's an interesting character who says a lot about the nature of the book and crosses worlds are Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe, who are both in the book. And, you know, they're frightfully important because they're connected to everybody. I mean, Marilyn Monroe meets Khrushchev, so that's very useful for me. She has an affair with the Kennedy brothers. She's friends with Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra is also friends with the mafia. You know, Sam Giancana, and he and Frank Sinatra introduces Sam Giancana's girlfriend, Judith Exner, to Jack Kennedy, and later becomes, and is later great friends with Ronald Reagan. And he's also really kind of one of the first pop singers, pop stars in the age of mass consumerism, the mass consumer age, which, you know, after World War II and during World War II with the Bobby Soxers. So Frank Sinatra is somebody who weirdly ticks lots of boxes in this. I mean, he's like a nexus of politics, consumerism, music, politics. So he's a fascinating character. So I guess Frank Sinatra or Marilyn Monroe would be surprising people that are featured in the book. But David Bowie, of course, is absolutely essential. I mean, you really can't. And he, of course, links up to the first walking on the moon, because Space Oddity came out at exactly that moment. And Space Oddity is such an important song in many ways. And of course, there's a playlist linked to this book. I've done a soundtrack to World History of all the history pop songs, which, and I think, you know, David Bowie and the Stones and people like that are in it. So, yeah.
Did you see that little video that went viral of Bowie the other week, where he was talking in 1999 about the internet and all?
Yes, I did.
Paxman is being Paxman and being quite obnoxious with him, and Bowie's like, "No, shut up, fool! This is what's going to happen. It's going to redefine this and this and this." And he's absolutely spot on, isn't he?
Well, you know what you realize. I never met David Bowie, but I've met some other kind of rock star characters, and they're all so intelligent. But obviously, you know, Bowie was a sort of visionary character, fascinating person. And he was so right on the internet. And of course, the internet is a big part of this book. And it goes right up to Elon Musk and, you know, Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and all these people are in it at the end. So, and of course, the internet is a massive change. And one of the big challenges that we have as a human race, as a civilization in going to the future, is how to control it, how to live with it, how to stop it undermining, you know, democracy and so on, and also privacy. So that is a big part of it. And Bowie was a major prophet of that.
He really was. This next question is a cheeky one. So it's obviously an international publication. So, and it's already out in Dutch, I think, was the first translation that's been done. Do the versions differ at all? So did you have to tailor your approach, like, for instance, for the American market? If we were to pick up, like, two different versions, are they exactly the same?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm correcting it all the time. I mean, because, of course, there are typos.
This is one of these things that's never going to be finished, isn't it?
No, it's never going to be finished. I mean, I'm always finding typos and little mistakes, which I'm correcting, of course. So that's different. So the American edition will be the most up to date. The paperback will have everything corrected in it, I think. And, you know, and of course, in a book like this, I mean, you know, I'm responsible for any of the mistakes in the book, and I'll correct them as people write in and say, like, my God, you know, there's a falling typo here or something like that. So of course I'm correcting things. So, but no, I mean, this is it. I mean, obviously there are parts of the world that I would like to have done more about. I mean, for example, you know, I really wanted to do a whole section on Madagascar because that's just the most fascinating, country. But, you know, I just couldn't justify having it in there. And so it was quite a lot less. And also there's less than I'd like on Sweden, which I feel very guilty about. And sometimes wake up in the night, you know, feeling bad about that. But, luckily,
you get Charles XII in, though. He's one of my favourites.
Charles XII is in. Yeah. Charles XII is in, and Gustavus Adolphus is in, and Bernadotte is in, the first of this dynasty of kings. But, you know, I'd like to have done more on Gustavus Adolphus and Charles XII. But obviously, Charles XII is very important because of Russia, and Russia and Ukraine are big parts of it. And I was going to finish the book on the day that the first person died of COVID in Wuhan.
Yeah.
But obviously when Putin invaded Ukraine, that meant I had to sort of rewrite the end of the book, which was a bit of a crisis. And delayed the sort of publication of the book by about a month, which was not good, but stuff happens, right?
It does feel like this is the sort of the perfect time to release the book, though, at the moment. It feels, the world feels kind of broken, and it has the potential, this book has the potential to be incredibly important. What do you think we can draw from the narrative that you've created?
I mean, I think one of the great things is, you know, about world history is, you know, it is a medicine for tough times. It's a medicine for fear. It gives perspective, and that's one of the joys of world history. I mean, on a sort of minor, very Anglo-centric, on two very Anglo-centric points. I mean, one is Brexit, for example. I mean, you know, it's no secret that I voted to remain in the European Union. But I'm not one of those people who are completely hysterical about Brexit either. Mm. And I think, you know, I mean, it certainly seems like it's a very bad idea now. And that may turn out to be true, but we're literally only about 3 or 4 years into this. And of course, in a world history, even its greatest opponents would admit that, you know, something could happen in the European Union to Italy, for example, or it could be a major political crisis with Hungary and its sort of authoritarian, semi-democratic government. And either of these things could cause a massive crisis in the European Union. And actually, amazingly, everyone could turn around and say, actually, it was just as well we weren't linked to the European Union at this point. But certainly at the moment, it seems like a bad idea. But that's, so, for example, covering that, I probably cover it much less dramatically than many people would expect. I put it in its perspective. And another thing is, you know, of course, today everyone is obsessed, especially in England, with the European, with the British Empire, and whether it's a good thing and a bad thing. This book is filled with the crimes of the British Empire and other empires too. But I do think that we're living in a time that's very, very strangely parochial and Anglo-centric. And I do think that we should look at other countries and other empires as well as studying our own. Obsessionally, and I think that's one of the things the book does. But you know, we've already mentioned migration, we've already mentioned technology. Another thing that, you know, we have to look at is nuclear power. Yeah. Another thing we have to look at is the supply of food and how food, just, you know, globalization of food supply, and that how that is going to have to be changed. Now we see that we were over dependent on foreign supply. So these are all themes that appear, but one of them is population. And we've now reached 8 billion people on Earth. And the population predictions in the next sort of 50 years are really dramatic. I mean, China is already going down. If it is about to go down. India is still increasing. Places like Indonesia are vastly increasing. And in Africa, Nigeria and Ethiopia, and Egypt are going to massively increase in their population and become giant countries with the greater than they are now. They may all become African superpowers, but may not. And judging by the governance of these countries, they won't, and their governments would struggle, and that could lead to massive migration northwards to countries like England and France. So these are some of the things that we look at. And then, of course, nuclear power. I mean, there are 8 or 9 nuclear powers with nuclear weapons now. There could be many more. And one of the lessons of the Ukraine war may be that, you know, if you can get nuclear power, that does give you some security. But that means that there'll be many more people with nuclear weapons. And in the end, rather like the rifle on the wall of Chekhov's, in Chekhov's play, that he refers to, and I quote at the end of the book, in the end, somebody's going to use one of these things. So all of these things are things that we need to prepare for and look at carefully. So those are some of the themes looking forward.
We haven't even touched on religion. Is Islam going to become the world's dominant religion?
May well do. It may well do. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the features we touched on, apocalyptic fears earlier. And you know, one of the features of human nature is definitely religiosity. I think one of the ironic things that we now in the West, I use the word West advisedly because the West now includes Japan, South Korea, places like that. So I prefer the open world is what I call it in the book. But, you know, in the open world, which is overwhelmingly secular, even America is still essentially secular despite a massive evangelical power. But we think of ourselves as secular. Actually, we're still follow orthodoxies in a religious way. And you only have to look at some of the controversies we're seeing in society now about all sorts of orthodoxies. We look back at the Christological crises of Byzantium as if they were mad. But look at some of the cultural crises, what you're looking at, cultural crises we're looking at today, and people looking back think of them as just as crazy, I think. So we're still living in a very religious age, and I don't think that's over. I think an interesting thing to say, though, is that because we are secular, we don't know how to handle religious societies. So, for example, with the Iran revolution that's going on right now, I mean, Iran is a huge part of this book, Persia and Iran. I follow in great detail. I'm obsessed with that Iranian history. And, you know, when you look at what's happening in Iran today, this is a sort of really vicious dictatorship, ruled by only two dictators for the last 50 years, effectively. And yet the sort of Western media is extremely kind of nervous about how to characterize it. They virtually never call supreme leader Ali Khamenei a dictator. Iranians do. They're chanting death to the dictator every day in the streets and being shot for it. But you never see that commented on by the BBC. And I think that's partly because we're all struck and slightly frightened of religious feeling.
Just finally, before we go, Chris, you'll be really disappointed. I've had a look in the index and Princess Victoria Louise does not get a mention. Kaiser Wilhelm gets quite a few mentions, but I think, Simon, before you shoot off after this interview, Chris might want to make a case for his favourite historical character.
I'm happy for him to do that. I'm sure everyone's looking at it and say, you know, I'm sure everyone is looking at it and finding that there's certain people that aren't in it. And there are less of the British royal family than you might expect.
Yeah.
But that's just because, you know, it really follows, much less on British history than we're used to. I mean, Queen Victoria is in it, but much less important too than, when I think she's a much less important figure really than she's usually, I think she's usually given a lot more credit as a powerful person than actually is justified by the history. And there's less Tudors too. There's much less Tudors in here than you.
Yeah, we're fed up with the Tudors on History Hack. Yeah, they get too much attention.
I agree.
I do predict, though, that the next 5 years of your life, at least, is going to be people coming up to you and going, well, you didn't say anything about this person and you didn't say anything about that person. And you having to politely smile and nod and explain that it's already like, I'm guessing, is it nigh on 500,000 words? Are we getting that?
It is. And I think I've made really difficult decisions. I mean, yes, there's much less. There's very little on the Tudors, which will be pleased. So a lot of people will be pleased to hear about. And there's much less about the House of Windsor than appear in most histories. I think Elizabeth II and Charles III only get about one mention each in the book. Well, I was a lot more about the Trumps and Kennedys and Roosevelts and Assads and Kims and President Xi and Putin. So I think that gives you an idea of the sort of emphasis in the book. But you're right. I'm going to be challenged forevermore about leaving people out.
Simon, it is a tour de force. It really redefines epic history. You could knock someone out with it. It's a big book, but it's 100% worth reading because it is, not only is it comprehensive, but I think people will just be constantly surprised as they go through it as well with where you take them on your narrative journey. So congratulations. The book,
World,
A Family History, is out now. We will put it in the History Hack bookshop so that people can jump on and buy it. But thank you very much for coming back on, and do come back anytime to talk about any of the other books.
Well, I love being on History Hack, so thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you guys. I'm Chris, nice to meet you. And Alex, great to see you again. So Brilliant. More soon. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.